Hello, and welcome back to the Rust Belt Risters podcast. My name is Andrew Roman. My apologies for missing the past 3 weeks of pretty crazy Penguins and NHL news. 3 weeks ago, I was getting ready to go on vacation. I figured I would have enough time before I left, but I was kind of lazy with my packing and getting the house ready and everything, so I had to kind of shelve that idea. And then on the return trip, we had some trouble getting home from that same trip, so it was kind of tricky that way. And then as more and more news just kept coming out from the Penguins, I didn't really have much of an opportunity to get all of my thoughts into pen and paper, and so now it's taken me 3 weeks to finally get to this point. And of course, as is destined to happen anytime I kind of can't do this as often as I would like to, the reality of the situation is that the Penguins are quite literally a different team than they were the last time I was speaking into your eardrums. My intention is to go through all of the major events of the past couple of weeks, particularly concerning the Penguins. I'm not going to spend as much time on some of the other teams in the league making both good and bad moves. But in order to do that, I kind of want to keep things to sequential order in terms of when they actually played out. So the rundown for this week's episode looks like this. Olimata Dominic Cahoon trade. Penguins at the draft. Jim Rutherford gets Hockey Hall of Fame call. Phil Kessel trade. And the Brandon Tanev signing. Jumping right in with the Kahuna Matata trade. Honestly, when I started my preparation for the episode a couple of weeks ago, I was in pretty good spirits. Taken in isolation, I really like this Olimata for Dominic Cahoon trade. I certainly won't ignore that what followed afterwards was mostly one mistake after another, but this trade is mostly fine. It was just a few weeks ago that I spoke about how Mata was a player who doesn't seem to live up to his contract, that he's overly dependent on his deployment, both in terms of who he plays against and who he plays with. I also described him as a player that the Penguins should trade if they could. And if we go back to my list of top targets, that included Patrick Hornquist, Jack Johnson, and Brian Rust, along with Mata, I kind of felt like Mata would be the easiest to trade amongst those underperforming players because he's younger, he carries that first-round pedigree, even though that was a few years ago at this point, and despite my warnings against this, I think he is the easiest for other teams to kind of look at and quote-unquote project as though he'll become something different with a different change of scenery compared to his time in Pittsburgh. The Penguins made good to trade him for a young, cheap, middle six winger who offers great positional flexibility, skates like the wind, and can be counted on for somewhere between 15 to 20 goals and 30 plus points. And if that sounds familiar to something else I've talked about, it should. Dominic Cahoon is exactly the type of player I had in mind when I previously described Brian Rust as a replaceable player on the Penguins lineup. Just keep this in mind as I go through these details. Brian Rust is entering his 28-year-old season, which means that he's probably in the back half of his professional career. He makes $3.5 million against the cap, and last year was the most productive year of his career. In that year, he scored 18 goals, 17 assists for 35 points. Dominic Cahoon produced 13 goals, 24 assists for 37 points. Now, there are some caveats to this. Cahoon got more time on the power play than Rust has ever seen in his whole career, but it's also true that Cahoon spent more time in a down roster role than Rust did. For some perspective on that, consider that Rust played 521 minutes with Sidney Crosby last season. In that time, he was a 52% Corsi 4 and a 54% high danger scoring chance 4. He played 347 minutes away from Crosby and saw his numbers drop to 48% Corsi 4 and 45% high danger scoring chance 4. Cahoon did get some time on Chicago's top line with Jonathan Toews, 399 minutes to be certain, and delivered a 51% Corsi 4 percentage and 45% high danger chance 4 percentage, but he also played 535 minutes away from Toews, yielding a 49% Corsi 4 and 44% high danger chance 4. So ultimately, there's not really much to differentiate the two players, except that Cahoon is entering his 24-year-old season, and he's coming off of his first season of North American hockey. That is, apart from a short stint in the OHL during the 2012-13 season. He also only makes $925,000. If you want to be pessimistic about it, the Penguins are exposing themselves to some risk. Cahoon's success last year is almost unprecedented. He made the leap directly from the DEL, the German Elite League, to the NHL. In fact, Cahoon had never played North American hockey outside of a partial season in the OHL in 2012-13. But he is also playing on his entry-level contract, which means that he is in fact waiver-exempt. So even if he can't quite replicate his success from last year, which, be mindful, is great success, the Penguins can still send him to the minors, and they control his rights for effectively four more seasons. Ultimately, the big takeaway from this trade is that the Penguins traded an underachieving asset and acquired one that's cheap enough to not matter, but who definitely has the ability to fill a valued role on this roster at a reduced cost, and that makes it a good trade. Whether the Penguins maximize the cap savings from this trade is debatable, but taking in isolation, I like this move. One of the biggest surprises of the past few weeks is that the Penguins did in fact make a first-round draft pick this year. It was the team's first first-round pick at all since drafting Kasperi Kapanen in 2014. That was Jim Rutherford's first year on the job, to be quite clear. While it's refreshing that the team made a pick, it's also true that, at this point, the Penguins don't truly have the luxury of developing talent with the intention of helping in the Crosby-Malkin era, so I wouldn't have been totally shocked or surprised if they had traded the pick for more immediate help. And before you say that the Penguins need to get younger in an effort to ease the burden on Crosby, Malkin, Letang, which is a talking point that we've seen Jim Rutherford give a lot recently, please do bear in mind that Evgeny Malkin and Chris Letang have contracts expiring three seasons from now, and there's no guarantee that they will both be back after that. It's also true that late first-round picks, which the Penguins were picking in the 21 spot this year, they typically take 3 or 4 years of development at minimum. So at this point, it would probably be more irrational to assume that Sam Poulin will be here in time to make a difference with this current group than it would be to say that he could be a piece of the next era of Penguins hockey. Nevertheless, Samuel Poulin was the Penguins' first-round pick, and following the Olimata trade, he is one of only three first-round picks originally drafted by the Penguins still in the organization, joining literally Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin in that regard. Poulin is a big-bodied power forward with good, albeit not eye-popping, offensive outputs. Ultimately, he's the type of player who looks better than his numbers would suggest at the junior level. The takeaway with Poulin is that the Penguins didn't reach to take him. He was projected as a mid-20s draft choice, and realistically, because of his size, his commitment to training, and potential offensive upside, he offers a safe floor for the team. But the team also didn't take a chance on available players who could offer a higher ceiling, such as Arthur Kaliev, Ryan Suzuki, or Bobby Brink. The Penguins didn't have a second-round pick, but they traded into the third round to add Nathan Laguerre. He's a similar big-bodied, strong power forward to Poulin. In fact, apparently they're friends. They have been for many years. Laguerre is intriguing in that he has a more noticeable weakness. He's not a particularly quick skater, but his junior productivity is far more noticeable, particularly in the goal-scoring department, where he potted 45 goals in 68 games with Baie-Comeau Dakar of the QMJHL. If I may be so bold, Laguerre dominated the team's development camp a couple weeks ago, prompting multiple think pieces wondering if, based on his junior production and how impressive he was at the development camp, if he could be the latest mid-round steal for the Penguins, following in the footsteps of Jake Guentzel, Chris Letang, you could even throw Brian Rust into that mix. The Penguins rounded out the draft by taking another large forward, Judd Caulfield, in the fifth round, and then used a pair of seventh-round picks to draft forward Valtteri Puustinen and defenseman Santeri Arola, both from Finland. Overall, it wasn't the most stimulating of all draft classes. I mean, there wasn't any marquee trades or anything like that that happened at the draft. But it's also true that the draft itself feels a little bit more robust than many that the Penguins have had recently, given that they actually made 5 picks. Look, this kind of marks the midway point of the episode this week. at least roughly speaking, I think I'm going to spend the most time talking about Phil of any of the moves that we're going to talk about today. But, you know, look, the rest of this episode is like, why did they do what they did? And that kind of sucks. But I'm also not going to deny that Jim Rutherford deserves to be in the Hockey Hall of Fame. As soon as he won the Cup with the Penguins in 2016, he clinched that honor. He's one of only two general managers to ever win the Cup with two separate franchises, and further, all three of his wins as a general manager came in the 30-team NHL, and all three came during the salary cap era. I mean, ultimately, JR is pretty much the only general manager in the history of the NHL to actually have to overcome those types of odds. It's really hard to win in a crowded 16 playoff team field. It's hard to win when you can only spend so much money. It's hard to win when there is a competitive draft and you can't just sign players from your home province or whatever the case may be. Overall, Rutherford's achievements are pretty much unparalleled in the NHL at this point. It's also true, however, that most of Jim Rutherford's run with the Hartford Whalers and Carolina Hurricanes organization was pretty bad. He missed the playoffs in 14 out of 19 seasons there. And I can't help but feel that Rutherford is prone to tinkering too much with the Penguins roster of late. As reported by Josh Yohe of The Athletic, Rutherford has traded 45 players in 5 years with the Penguins. My entirely personal, humble opinion is that looking at the Penguins as they are constructed right this moment, I truly believe that they're closer to the playoff bubble entering the 2019-20 season than I believe that they are as a formidable Stanley Cup favorite. I get the sense that tensions are building between Rutherford and Mike Sullivan, and while I can't really get a sense for the front office's involvement in all of this, I have to wonder if they are fully on board with Rutherford's decision-making of late. Further, the Penguins did announce on July 5th that Sullivan has signed a contract extension for the next 4 seasons after this year. While I'm sure the Penguins aren't going to fire Jim Rutherford in his Hall of Fame season, I wonder if he could be getting closer to the inevitable kicked upstairs treatment, where the team may hand the GM duties off to Bill Guerin and name Rutherford as president of hockey operations, or something that's meaningless, but it's a nice honorific. Of course, if the Penguins truly were preparing to cut back Rutherford's role, they probably would not have let him trade one of their top five players on the current roster and a future Hall of Famer, which I'm going to come back to probably a couple more times here, of Phil Kessel's caliber. But here we are. Away goes Phil, a fourth round pick in next year's draft, and low-tier college prospect Dane Burks. In comes Alex Galchenyuk and defenseman Pierre-Olivier Joseph, a 2017 first-round pick. Do I like this trade? Not really. I like it less than the package that was offered from the Minnesota Wild, especially when they were willing to take on Jack Johnson's contract too. And for whatever it's worth, I didn't totally love the details of that trade either. But it's also true that compared to other trades that teams have made to clear away cap space, namely Toronto giving away their first-round pick next year to Carolina in order to get Carolina to buy out Patrick Marleau's contract, and whatever it is that Nashville got from New Jersey in exchange for PK Subban, this trade still has the look and feel of a real hockey trade. I'll get into the Galchenyuk and Joseph of it all in a moment, but first I want to look back at Phil's run in Pittsburgh. I think it's easy to forget, but this is exactly what most pundits and opinion havers on the internet expected to happen when the Penguins made the trade for Phil in the first place. He would spend 3 or 5 years in Pittsburgh, and then the team would look to move him before the aging curve caught up to him and his contract became a challenge to move. I think what most pundits and opinion havers didn't expect is that Kessel's time in Pittsburgh would be so massively successful. When the Penguins made the trade, it looked like a last gasp, desperation move of a franchise that was fading from relevance. It was a Hail Mary before the team started selling off the Marc-Andre Fleurys and Evgeny Malkins and Chris Letangs on the roster. 340 days after making the trade, however, the Penguins were in fact Stanley Cup champions, and Phil was the leading postseason scorer for that team. He really should have won the Conn Smythe that year. Then the Penguins did it again in 2016 and 2017. Back-to-back champions of the hardest trophy to win in all of professional sports. The first team in a new era of parity for the league to successfully defend the title. The first in the salary cap era. The third and fourth years of Phil's time in Pittsburgh may not have ended in Stanley Cup victories, but they were good for Phil's brand and legacy. He posted 92 and 82 points respectively in the past two seasons. I said it earlier and I stand by it. Phil Kessel is going to be a Hall of Famer, and he earned that largely during his time in Pittsburgh. It was the points that he scored, it was the championships that he won, it was the acclaim that he got for his performance in the playoffs that ultimately set this guy up to be a Hall of Famer when his career comes to an end. Don't let the Rob Rossies, Josh Yoes, and Mark Maddens of the world spoil his legacy in Pittsburgh. He was nothing but a gamer and a consummate professional who was beloved by the fans in his time here. His time here worked so well because he was the perfect release valve for Crosby and Malkin. Maybe he wouldn't have been so impressive on another team, but he sure knew how to finish the ample opportunities he got from those guys here. And his power play work will be pretty much impossible to replace, both in terms of facilitating all of those breakouts that never changed in terms of like the drop passes and that kind of structure, because the teams never managed to shut them down because Phil was just too good at them, and also just making all of those plays from the left half wall. But it's also true that I respect Phil's alleged unwillingness to play a third line role in Pittsburgh, much like Jordan Staal had the same unwillingness to do the same 7 years ago. And I do believe that he's a player that is going to march to the beat of his own drummer. One of the Phil Kessel appreciation themes I've seen lately, and this is something that I largely agree with, is that Phil is an anti-athlete. I don't think he's a hockey automaton in the vein of Sidney Crosby or Chris Letang. I think he likes to do things that aren't hockey, and that's great. I also think that in a sport such as hockey, that behavior reads as particularly other compared to many of his peers. And as such, that makes him harder to coach. I think he's harder to get along with in a player-media relationship as well, and thus it's easy to try to paint him as a quote-unquote bad character player, even though there's literally zero evidence to support that. So I guess in closing that chapter, I say happy trails, Phil. I hope you find what you're looking for in the desert. As I mentioned earlier, coming back to Pittsburgh in the trade are Alex Galchenyuk and Pierre-Olivier Joseph. Joseph is exciting largely because he's a defenseman. I would submit that if I had been able to make my episode of kind of pre-draft coverage when I wanted to, I was somewhat optimistic that the Penguins would have been in a position to take a player such as Cam York or maybe Moritz Seider. Ultimately, because the team's defensive prospect pool is even shallower than the kiddie pool-sized forward prospect pool that they currently boast. At least when we're talking about forward prospects, we can look at the upside of players like Jordy Bellerive, Casper Bjorkqvist, and Philip Hollander, all of whom will be joining the AHL team this year. While when we look at the defensive kind of prospect pool, we see literally one name, and it's Kalen Addison, and he's basically the only actual NHL caliber defenseman prospect that is currently in the system, at least before this trade was executed. But with Joseph, the Penguins get a player with pretty similar credentials to many of the mid to late first round talents that were available in this year's entry draft, but instead of getting that player with two more years of juniors ahead of them, Joseph is able to join the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins this season. I believe he just celebrated his 20th birthday at the beginning of July, and as such, that kind of accelerates his development clock by 2 years compared to a first round pick at this year's draft. By all accounts, Joseph is somewhat similar to Marcus Pettersson. He's tall, 6'2", but he's really skinny, 161 pounds. He's known as a good skater who's good at using his reach, and he possesses decent vision on the breakout, but he's probably not going to score at a real prodigious rate at the NHL. He's kind of one of those, you know, transition players, but he's not necessarily going to be an offensive dynamo in the vein of a Chris Letang, an Erik Karlsson, a Brent Burns, etc. The player that I can't quite figure out in this trade, however, is Alex Galchenyuk. The name is probably noteworthy to many. He was the third overall pick in the 2012 NHL entry draft, the one that was held in Pittsburgh, and he is a one-time 30-goal scorer. But this also marks the second consecutive summer in which he's been traded. Last year, the Coyotes acquired Galchenyuk from the Montreal Canadiens in exchange for Max Domi. But the most puzzling part of his inclusion in the trade is his contract status. Although Galchenyuk is 25 and still fairly young, this does mark his seventh year in the NHL because he's been here since he was 18, which means that he's earned unrestricted free agency status when his current contract expires next summer. It's also true that Galchenyuk is basically like a dime store version of Phil Kessel, insofar as he's fairly weak defensively and he relies on the power play in order to get his points. Unlike Phil, though, he's not that elite of a scorer with a career high of 56 points, and apart from his one 30-goal season, he's only scored 20 goals one other time in his past seven seasons. He's also a left-handed shot, which would seem to make it unlikely that he'll feature on the Penguins' top power play unit. So what I don't like about acquiring Galchenyuk is this. If he's not really good right away in Pittsburgh, which is something that we've seen repeatedly with players, including Phil Kessel, is that it could take a few months or a whole season, really, to get acclimated. He's probably little more than a one-year rental for the Penguins. He'll go to free agency next summer and get more from some other team than he'd get in Pittsburgh, and then he's going to feel compelled to take that money. And even if he is really good in Pittsburgh, he still probably won't be better than what Phil Kessel is, but he'll be in need of a new contract, and that new contract is probably going to pay him more than what he currently makes, $4.9 million, or in other words, he'll end up getting a new contract that will pay him basically what Phil makes to not be as good as Phil, and that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I'd like to think that I've at least been somewhat articulate in the past handful of weeks. I mean, pretty much as the ultimate underlying premise of why I even brought back the Rust Belt Roosters podcast, in trying to explain that overall, I think it is best to add the most talent as possible to the roster. And I have no doubt that Galchenyuk was the most skilled player that Arizona was willing to part with. I don't think they were going to give up Christian Dvorak. I don't think they were going to give up Clayton Keller or an Oliver Ekman-Larsson. I mean, although that would be kind of a different type of trade if it was Kessel for Ekman-Larsson. I also can't help but wonder, though, if there was a younger, cheaper, cost-controlled type of player that the Penguins could have added instead. One that would have kept them from doing the next thing they did once they cleared out Phil's salary from the roster. And of course, what they did was to sign Brandon Tanev to seemingly the longest contract in the NHL this year. I promise I'm not going to get bogged down on this signing. I feel like I can't even talk about the decision because I can't even begin to comprehend it. I've spent weeks in this space explaining that it's good and smart to invest in elite players, even though they cost more money. And I've also explained that bad players can't hurt your team as long as you don't pay them too much, or for too long. I've also stressed, though, that in that same vein, it's mid-tier contracts that will either make or break a team's chances of success. The biggest problem with this contract, however, is that it doesn't even really fit into this line of thinking. You're talking about 6 years, $21 million, with a partial no-trade clause to boot for a 27-year-old fourth liner with one full year of NHL experience. That's the bottom line. You literally can't say anything else to make this contract make sense. I'm like 98% certain that Rutherford thought he was signing Chris Tanev, which, still, yuck. But that would at least minimally explain what has to come next, because this contract in and of itself is completely inexcusable. So to kind of recap the events that I've just been talking about, the Penguins quite literally traded a future Hall of Famer plus a good, established NHL defenseman in order to clear salary to sign a fourth liner to an absurd contract. And by signing Brandon Tanev to this insane contract, they're completely neglecting the three promising young players on their roster who are RFA status, Zach Aston-Reese, Teddy Bluger, and Marcus Pettersson. technically all three of these players are still free to sign an offer sheet if some franchise wanted to come along and offer something that they couldn't refuse, namely Marcus Pettersson. I'm not so much worried about ZAR or Teddy Bluger, but Marcus Pettersson seemingly has a very bright future ahead of him in the NHL. And if you wanted to just sign him for, I don't know, $3 million a season for a couple of years, the Penguins probably are not in a position where they could match it right now. In order to even begin to think about signing those players as currently constructed, however, the team will need to send out another valuable roster player. More than likely, it's going to be either Brian Rust or Nick Bjugstad, because, you know, we know that it's not actually probably going to be Jack Johnson, because nobody wants to touch that contract, because the Penguins were bidding against absolutely nobody last summer for that contract. And whatever they would get in return for a Rust or a Bjugstad will be literally pennies on the dollar. Just to clear up this latest salary cap misadventure, this is 2 years running where the Penguins basically offered the most insane contract in all of free agency, and that's never a position that you want to be in. I won't say anything else other than to say that you cannot convince me that the Penguins are better now than they were when they got swept from the first round of the playoffs 3 months ago. They've done nothing to address their biggest need, which was on defense, and they've traded away a whole lot of offensive upside in the form of Phil Kessel, and they've only further handcuffed their own ability to make trades to improve the roster with this Brandon Tanev signing. I know I've wasted a decent amount of breath in the last few weeks talking about how I'm okay with trading Brian Rust, and honestly the same would apply to Nick Bjugstad too. But I'm not looking forward to one or both of those players going to New Jersey for a conditional 7th-round pick, and the condition being that they both have to score 60 goals. If you can trade from a position of strength to improve your roster, you do it. What the Penguins have to try to figure out now is how to trade from a position of strength to facilitate an ongoing string of gross mismanagements. These are the moves that paralyze your franchise, and that's all I can really add. Thanks for tuning in. If you've liked this podcast, please make sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you like what we're doing here, please check out our other podcasts, the Greedo Shot First podcast, a show that I host with my friend Connor Arlette. We talk about anything even freaking relating to Star Wars. And also the Games and App podcast, which still seems to be on hiatus, but it is what it is. For now, signing off. Thanks, guys.